My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar, I'd like to welcome all of you to the teleclass, Prevention of Ventilator-Associated Pneumonia. Robert Garcia is an infection control professional at Brookdale Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. I met him about 2 years ago when 200 or 300 of us got up very early for a 5:30 a.m. breakfast session at the APIC conference in 2004 to hear Robert Garcia give a lecture on ventilator-associated pneumonia. He had that early morning crowd on the edge of their seats. He is a very talented speaker and a very busy speaker. He's been all over the place, including Europe and Hawaii, which is very nice. He's also an author. In fact, he has an excellent article in the November issue of the American Journal of Infection Control. Hopefully he'll make reference to that again later. He is deeply dedicated to infection control, and on top of all of that, he is a really nice guy. Before Robert gets started, I'd like to say that we have a new sponsor with us today as well. Sage Products, Inc. sponsored the early morning lecture at that APIC conference, and I'm very grateful to them for offering to sponsor this teleclass lecture as well. The sponsorship funds we receive from our sponsors like Sage allow us to offer all of our teleclass materials for free to healthcare professionals in developing nations, and they use them by the tens of thousands. So on behalf of them and on my behalf, I will thank the nice folk at Sage very much for their support. Thank you. Now, to give the teleclass Prevention of Ventilator-Associated Pneumonia from the Brookdale Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, it is my very big honor to present Robert Garcia. Robert.
Thank you, Paul, so much. Thank you, Paul, for inviting me for the lecture and for Sage Products for their support. And I should add that, thank God, it's not 5:30 in the morning. But anyway, we have a lot of material to cover. So in the next hour, we're going to cover issues surrounding the prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia, or VAP. We're going to cover cost issues, why it's so important to prevent this kind of infection. We're going to cover the issues surrounding what has been advocated as preventive initiatives by such bodies as the CDC. And we'll also cover some new material, I think, for some of you in regard to newer initiatives that are now getting to be effective in many institutions across the United States. That is oral and dental care plans in order to reduce respiratory infection. So let's start with the second slide. Why is this such an important issue? Well, let's take a look at number one, national quality issues. In the United States, the AHRQ, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, several years ago, reviewed patient care practices in the United States, and they listed 73 of the most important practices that are commonly performed in hospitals in the United States. And among those is the notion that not only is this a basic medical practice, and that is, you know, placing patients on mechanical ventilation, but that it should be done in a certain manner in order to prevent the negative outcomes such as pneumonia from occurring. Then we have the Institute of Medicine's report published in 1999 to Urs Humming. Now, this is probably one of the most influential reports published in the last 20 to 25 years. Essentially, this report implicated medical institutions in America with having caused or contributed to the death of nearly 100,000 people to medical errors. Since that time, the umbrella of medical errors has come to include the inclusion of hospital-acquired infections. And in fact, follow-up reports by other organizations show that that figure may be twice as high as previously thought. The National Quality Forum, a major quality institution in the United States, has also issued their consensus standards, and one of those is the prevention of VAP. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement, on the next slide, is a national body that was created after the IOM report, and its basic aim is to improve the systems or the practices that occur within healthcare organizations, and their goal is to prevent the deaths of 100,000 patients in the United States between the beginning of this year and the middle of next year. Now, one of those initiatives that they have specifically addressed, and I believe that there are about six initiatives, is the prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia. And how they go about doing this is by recommending that institutions incorporate bundles, that is, groups of initiatives that have proven to be effective, as has been now reviewed in the literature. So among those may be raising the head of the bed, weaning protocols, and peptic ulcer prophylaxis. The next issue we need to look at is those involving regulatory bodies. Those of you in the United States well know the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission is a regulator in the United States and surveys hospitals on a 3-year basis, depending on their accreditation. The 2004 standard, which now really the 2006 standards have been issued, essentially that are aiming at infection control programs, broadly says that the organization uses a coordinated process to reduce the risks of nosocomial infections in patients and healthcare workers. So this has become a critical issue now in the U.S. for programs to institute the prevention of such infections, such as VAP. Next slide. There are also very important global infection control issues. You may want to read an article that I wrote with Bonnie Barnard and Virginia Kennedy out of Houston, Texas, back in 2000 in AJIC, the American Journal of Infection Control, which is titled The Fifth Evolutionary Era in Infection Control, Interventional Epidemiology. This reviews the history of infection control up to that point and essentially made recommendations as to where the profession should go. And on the next slide, what I do is I summarize for you the area of interventional epidemiologists. These are people such as infection control practitioners that need to take a different approach in the projects that they incorporate in their institutions. Now, in my 25 years in infection control, if I look back in the way that I was originally trained, it was mainly a clinical perspective, such as infectious diseases and microbiology, disinfection and sterilization, et cetera, et cetera. But the real world in healthcare today also involves considerations of finance, because obviously none of our institutions are going to be in existence if we continue to lose money. And the other major issue is customer satisfaction, and therefore those are things that we deal with outcomes are getting to be increasingly important here in the U.S. So those outcomes and the and that triad is where we have to concentrate our efforts today. So let's talk a little bit specifically about VAP. VAP is a high-risk, high-morbidity infection, and it is now one of the four targeted HAIs, hospital-acquired infections for prevention in the United States. VAP, central line infections, surgical site infections, and urinary tract infections associated with catheters. On the next slide, we'll go through some VAP facts. Mechanical ventilation increases the risk of pneumonia about 6 to 21 times, or about 1% per day. Think about that and ask yourselves, the average duration of a patient on a ventilator in your own institutions. If, for example, you have a patient who is on a ventilator for 7 days, his risk of acquiring pneumonia, therefore, is about 7%. And for those of you who have a large number of patients who may be intubated for longer periods of time, the risk may be exponentially higher for them. Another very important issue when we're talking about VAP is attributable mortality. Mortality increases about 27% when somebody is on a ventilator and increases to 43% when the agent that causes the infection is caused by either Pseudomonas or things like Acinetobacter, gram-negatives. This is increasingly becoming an important issue because of the facts of resistant antibiotic organisms occurring in our institutions. We'll talk about that in a minute. But VAP also increases the length of stay. In the literature, it's shown us to be patients with VAP on average have length of stays of 34 days versus 21 days for patients without VAP. This is critical because, at least in the U.S., those additional days where the person may be in a bed and have an infection, those are not reimbursable days to the institution, so it is a financial issue. On the next slide is one of the slides from the CDC. This is information from their National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System, or the NNIS. But I thought this was very interesting because it showed us over a period of 10 years that VAP, the percentage of patients with VAP, is upwards of 56% for patients in a ICU. And you could see the numbers for all the other breakdowns for the ICUs for over 300 hospitals who participate in this data gathering. I think that that is a significant finding. The next slide shows us some information on antimicrobial resistance. In the U.S., we can clearly see that there is almost 50% increase in resistant organisms, particularly those with gram-negative organisms, over the last 10 years or so. I'm sure that in the years 2000-2005, this number has increased even more. Many of these infections of VAP are caused by either gram-positives or the gram-negatives, some of them being certainly resistant organisms. If you look at the next slide, the ICU rates of VAP from the NIST study, we can clearly see that the information published by NIST showed pooled means, that is, the midpoint or the average of the VAP rates, and these are cases per 1,000 ventilator days. So the pooled mean over these last few years for a patient on a ventilator who develops VAP in a medical ICU, it's 4.9 per 1,000 ventilator days. The rate for medical surgical units in the U.S. during that time period, 5.4, and for a surgical ICU, 9.3. This information, really, what we boil it down to is that we have a long way to go in preventing these kinds of infections that are occurring. The next slide shows us the cost of VAP. Now, here are three very important studies that you can review in terms of outlining what the cost per VAP case is. The first study by Warren in 2003, which was a very, very well-designed study and statistically very accurate because of the statistical applicability that they used, showed us that the cost of VAP per case was about $12,000. There's another study that was published back in 2002 by Rello, which essentially looked at charges, and this was done for a large database used in the United States, over 800 patients in that review, showed that the cost of a VAP case was about $41,000. And the last one, comprehensive review for cost of VAP, published very recently in Surgical Infections magazine, was a cost of about $57,000. The next slide shows us a little bit more information from that Warren study. I wanted to go over with you the other information that they had as well. For a patient with VAP, the ICU length of stay was 26 versus 4 days for patients that did not have ventilator-associated pneumonia. For the overall hospital length of stay, 38 versus 13 days. Mortality, 50% versus 34%. This is very significant information. So on the next slide, what are the strategies that have been advocated in preventing VAP? Over the years, many studies have been published in these areas, and they're essentially summarized in the CDC guidelines, which we'll review in a second. And they range from things like the replacement of ventilator circuits, the use of HMEs, stress ulcer prophylaxis, and oral and dental care projects. If you look at the next slide, it's a photograph that I took many years ago when I was a very young infection control professional. This is a ventilator, obviously, but it is of very old technology. And many of you who are familiar with this kind of mechanisms know that respiratory therapists who service these machines while they were used on a patient, right in the center of the photograph, you have a part of that machine which was called a cascade. And a cascade was a device which we would add water to in order to maintain adequate humidity for that patient. And in the beginning, when these machines were designed, where did you get the water from? Well, it was just tap water. Essentially, what we were doing was really circulating the organisms that were being bubbled from this humidifier directly to the patient. So there were certainly many outbreaks recorded in association with these machines. In the next slide, you'll see much more modern technology. Not only these are computer controlled and all that, but the point is that humidification today is controlled in a very different fashion. There's no longer the need for adding water into the system in order to provide more humidification. That is controlled specifically by the humidification that is actually produced by the patient and not circulated through these machines. The risk of acquiring an organism from these machines now is much less than it was many years ago. And on the next slide, we have some information about outbreaks that have been associated with those kinds of units, mainly things gram-negatives like Acinetobacter, when these machines were not cleaned properly, particularly on the surfaces and the reusable items associated with that kind of mechanism. On the next page, we see a slide on the HCPCS guidelines, the guidelines issued by the CDC. They were issued in 2004. They are evidence-based. They are expert-reviewed. And the recommendations are categorized. On the next slide, you'll see these HCPCS categories. I won't read all of these, but just understand, for those of you not familiar with the guidelines, the Category 1A is the highest level recommendation, and it's based on randomized controlled studies that are well designed and therefore support that recommendation. On the next slide, we're going to talk about the first recommendation, and that is about ventilator circuits. Let's go to the next slide. Ventilator circuits themselves, the CDC recommends the following. Do not change routinely on the basis of duration of use the ventilator circuit, that is ventilator tubing and exhalation valve and the attached humidifier, that is in use on an individual patient. Change the circuit when it is visibly soiled or mechanically malfunctioning. So essentially, there have been now over 30 studies published about ventilator circuit replacements all the way back many years ago when it was looked at as to whether we should change it every 8 hours or 16 hours or every 24 hours and, you know, 7 days, et cetera, et cetera. And we progressed to the point where we now know that particularly contributory to this is the use of HME filters, and we'll make that association in a second. On the next slide, I have circled here for you an HME filter itself. Those of you who may not be familiar with the technology, this is a heat moisture exchanger, and I mentioned to you earlier about the control of humidification from the patient. These filters are designed to essentially stop one of two things, the secretions that are generated from the patient, and you could see the patient's mouth in the top right-hand corner of the photograph, if designed correctly, and the filter, you know, is designed for that purpose, not to allow those secretions to go through into the circuit and therefore to the machine. Secondly, they may be also designed to stop the passage of bacteria through this filter as well. If we look at the next slide, the question is the filter hydroscopic or hydrophobic? That is, does it stop bacteria or does it stop secretions from going through or fluids in itself? Some filters are designed to do both. So I think that if you do have some questions, you should go to your respiratory therapist or find out from your vendors what kind of filters are being provided for the institution, and is there a need to go to a better filter or a differently designed filter to reduce the possible contamination in the circuits of bacteria-laden secretions. Let me just read to you two HCPCS recommendations regarding HME. Do not routinely change more frequently than every 48 hours an HME that is in use on a patient. And then it says, do not change routinely in the absence of gross contamination or malfunction the breathing circuit attached to an HME while it is in use on a patient. Okay? So it's fairly clear what we should be doing with these HME filters. Be very careful also when we're giving medications, because my understanding is that many times when you're going to be giving medications through the circuit, respiratory therapists disconnect the HME filter so that the medication passes to the patient. What do people do with that filter? Is it replaced? Is it placed, you know, let's say, on top of the ventilator or on the patient environment? And we have to be very careful because that filter is probably filled with organisms on one side, on the patient side, that may contaminate the environment itself. The next slide is a study on circuits and HMEs, on VAP outcome itself. This was a study to determine if vent circuits are needed to be changed periodically when an HME is used. And the results are, when we looked at the two different randomized control groups, 1.71 VAP cases occurred per 1,000 ventilator days versus 1.25. There was no significant difference when this issue was being looked at. Okay, the next slide. Let's review the use of closed suction. Closed suction is one of the most universally accepted devices when using for ventilator patients. I would say at least in the United States, probably 80 to 90% of all patients, you have closed suction being used. My question is there a randomized controlled study which clearly shows that the use of this kind of device prevents ventilator-associated pneumonia from occurring? The answer is no. There has never been a study published like that. On the next slide, although the manufacturers have come out and said that you should replace this device at 24 hours, HCPCS says that no recommendation can be made about the frequency of routinely changing the inline suction catheter of a closed suction system in use on one patient. Their review of the literature clearly shows that there is no evidence that it should be replaced at 24 hours. This really should be an issue decided by the individual facilities. And I know of many facilities changing these inline suction devices at greater than 24 hours. And this is certainly a cost issue. And if you do that, you should just take a close look at your VAP cases. And if you have no difference, then there really should be no reason why you continue to change those at 24 hours. If you look at closed versus open suctioning, here's a study that showed that there is no difference in percentage of patients developing VAP between those two technologies. The real issue about using closed suction is to avoid the spread of organisms in the environment when an individual is suctioning. Because in open suction procedures, you might have some splashing of the sputum into the patient's environments, which may spread the organism. On the next slide, you have a slide regarding a study designed to measure the impact of decreasing the frequency of inline suction catheter changes. And here's an institution that did daily changes, and the rate was 0.19, and then they did seven-day changes, zero, no infections. Their annual savings was more than $18,000. The next slide shows us an abstract that was published in the 2002 APIC conference. And what this organization did was that they looked at the tubings, the HME, and the inline suction catheters as a single device. And when it was soiled or malfunctioned, they would change all three devices. And look at the outcomes here. The rates went from 28.7 down to 9.8 cases per 1,000 ventilator days. Very significant findings. Let's mention a little bit about subglottic suctioning. I don't know how many of you are using this kind of device. From many of the institutions that I've talked to, there are not that many using this. Certainly one of the things about subglottic suctioning, there's been several studies published about this. One of the problems that I understand is using a device that has a separate lumen for continuous suctioning is that the lumen is very small and that oftentimes it does become clogged. What do you do in that circumstance? If to change the endotracheal tube places the patient at even greater risk for aspiration of the secretions that form above the cuff of the endotracheal tube. So I'm not that sure that that's such a wonderful option. And also, do you place this type of endotracheal tube in every single patient who's intubated, even though they're going to be intubated for a short period of time, although we think they may be intubated for a short period of time, or those that we think might be intubated for longer periods. The HCPCS recommendation is that if it is feasible, use an endotracheal tube with a dorsal lumen for continuous subglottic suctioning. The next slide is a meta-analysis of five studies published on that. If the patients are expected to require greater than 72 hours of ventilation, subglottic secretion suctioning shortened the duration of ventilation by 2 days, length of stay by 3 days, and delayed onset of pneumonia by about 6.5 days. So it's an interesting finding here. Semi-recumbent positioning essentially is raising the head of the bed by 30 to 45 degrees. Now, there actually has been 4 studies that have been conducted on this issue, all of them done in Spain. But the only one that linked up the outcome of the effect on VAP is the one that you see published here in The Lancet in 1999. The CDC recommends that this be done. It's a Category 2 recommendation, so at least that there is one study that is fairly well designed which does show some good evidence that this is effective. One of the reasons that this probably should be incorporated for all patients, or at least most patients, is that it doesn't cost you anything to do that. The problem is, take a look on the next slide, how high is 30 degrees? Now, I cheated here a little bit because obviously this is a specialty bed and you could measure the angle of the head of the bed, but many institutions don't have these beds for all their patients, and therefore if they're on a ventilator, how do you actually measure that? I won't read all of this slide, but there are a number of patients in different categories where you can't raise the head of the bed for a number of reasons, for medical complications and other kinds of things that we can't raise the head of the bed. So this is not necessarily a universal policy for every patient on a ventilator. Stress ulcer prophylaxis. This is certainly one of the recommendations right now through the IHI. Essentially, it's a theory that modifying stomach acid affects the bacterial colonization level. HCPAT says no recommendation can be made for the preferential use of sucralfate or H2 antagonists or antacids for stress bleeding prophylaxis. In a review by Livingston published in the American Journal of Surgery in 2000, they state the following: after all this time of study, it is likely that neither drug has any advantage in significantly maintaining gastric flora and reducing VAP. So I'm not that sure necessarily that this is a very prominent issue to address, but certainly it's something that may need to be incorporated if you're participating in initiatives such as IHI. On the next slide, we have the issue of selective digestive decontamination. Now, this is an intervention whereby the theory is about preventing decolonization and assuming that the gut is a major source of organisms that cause VAP. HCPAC says that no recommendation can be made for the routine selective decontamination of the digestive tract of all critically ill mechanically ventilated or ICU patients. There have been more than 30 studies to date on this issue. What is of great, great concern is that if you're giving antibiotics to patients for prophylactic treatment to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia, there may be increasing pressure on developing resistant organisms, and this practice alone may negate that as being a type of initiative that any institution may incorporate it. So this is not an intervention that is very high on the list. The next one, I think, is one of the handful of very critical things that every institution should do, and that is weaning protocols. And the whole issue here is duration. I mentioned to you earlier that the risk of VAP increases about 1% per day. So the issue of individuals such as respiratory therapists getting involved and having a team approach where a team that reviews these vent cases every day asks the question, does the person still need to be ventilated? Can they be weaned off? Or can you begin the weaning process? Is a critical thing to start even 24 hours after initial intubation. And I have here for your review is two references that have been coordinated by major organizations in regard to weaning protocols. Some of them are fairly lengthy, but they contain the basic information from these experts in regard to establishing weaning protocols and how to do that, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that this is a pretty critical issue. Let's take a look at the cost of mechanical ventilation. If you want to put this into dollars, take a look at this study that's just been published in Critical Care Medicine. It was a retrospective cohort study designed to examine the costs associated with mechanical ventilation itself. 253 hospitals, more than 51,000 patients were looked at. The mean cost of patients with a ventilator was about $31,000, and the mean cost for patients that did not have mechanical ventilation was about $12,000. They concluded that the incremental cost of mechanical ventilation per day was more than $1,500. So for every day that the person is not weaned off the ventilator, it can cost the institution thousands of dollars. Active weaning protocols, again, are pretty critical, and here is a study done by Dries, published in the Journal of Trauma last year, which clearly shows that an active protocol-driven vent plan essentially decreased the events of VAP from 17 cases to 5 cases in a 2-year span. So that's very significant numbers. multidisciplinary approaches are probably actually the way to go. The team approach, where a group institutes a variety of interventions that we would call a bundle, things such as the comprehensive oral care protocols, head of bed, daily sedation holidays, daily assessment for readiness, extubate. Here's a very good example of that. This, again, was an abstract published at the APIC conference this year. Clearly shows the outcomes here, a 26% reduction in VAP occurring among the patients that were studied in this review. Here's another study published by Lay in Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology 2003. Again, multifaceted. And what they found that in their MICU, instituting these bundles decreased VAP by 10.8 per 1,000 ventilator days. And in their SICU, almost twice that was reduced. Their net overall cost savings was almost $350,000. Now, on the next slide, here's a question that I think that all of us should be asking today. Is there scientific evidence that links oropharyngeal and dental colonization with respiratory illness? I've been fortunate enough to have an article just published in the November issue of the American Journal of Infection Control, and you may want to access that. And it's called A Review of the Possible Role of Oral and Dental Colonization on the Occurrence of Healthcare-Associated Pneumonia. I think that this is a very much underappreciated risk. And up to this point, much of the literature that's been published to associate oropharyngeal bacterial colonization and respiratory illness has not been published in the infection control literature. It's really been published in dental reviews, critical care journals, and other journals, but it is very wide-ranging. The studies that have been published have shown now reductions in respiratory illness when institutions instituted things like oral and dental care plans in institutions such as long-term care, nursing homes with ventilator patients, ICUs, and medical surgical units in hospitals, and even in patients who are not intubated, in patients, for example, veterans in long-term care facilities, and in many other kinds of settings, we have a lot of information now that intervening in that fashion is going to be very effective. Let's take a look at what HCPCS says about this. And in fact, in their last revision was the first time that they actually addressed the issue of oral hygiene. And they say, oral pharyngeal cleaning and decontamination with an antiseptic agent. Develop and implement a comprehensive oral hygiene program that might include the use of an antiseptic agent for patients in acute care settings or residents in long-term care facilities who are at high risk for healthcare-associated pneumonia. And the two studies there that you have referenced is the studies that they based their recommendation Category 2 after their review of the issue. Let's take a look at some of the evidence in the literature that has been published to support my view that this is a very important issue to address. First, let's take a look at a study in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine 1997. I think this is one of the better studies that has been published on the issues. Here's a prospective study of 86 mechanically ventilated ICU patients to assess the relationship between oropharyngeal colonization and the subsequent occurrence of pneumonia. What they tried to do was they tried to ask the basic question. When somebody developed respiratory illness, was it from the oropharyngeal cavity that it occurred from, or was it from gastric sources? And what they did was they took bronchoscopic specimens. They did DNA analysis on these, and they related it to specimens that were causing pneumonia in these patients. And on the next slide, I'll show you the summary of what they found. The column that says patients with OC are those with oropharyngeal colonization. And overwhelmingly, the findings were that the organisms that caused the respiratory illness in these patients were associated with organisms that first started in the oropharyngeal tract. The next slide shows you three more studies in that area on that same issue of gastric colonization. The next bit of evidence is number two, decontamination of the oropharynx. Here is a study done by Bergman's published in 2001, a prospective randomized double-blind study of ICU patients. that determine when VAP while manipulating oropharyngeal colonization and without influencing gastric or intestinal colonization. In other words, what they did was they either gave a control group a placebo or they gave another group of patients topical antibiotics, and then they measured the outcome of VAP. And in the study group where they gave the antibiotics, there was a rate of 10% VAP among those patients. And in the controlled group, it was almost three times as high, 27%, which shows us then more evidence that when you control the bacterial levels in the mouth, it reduces the outcome of respiratory illness. Now, on the next slide, three additional studies that have been published, again, regarding the intervention of antibiotic paste or solution, giving more evidence about oropharyngeal colonization. Number three, oral decolonization, the use of chlorhexidine. Here's, again, a very good study designed by DeRizzo, published in Chest in 1996, done among more than 350 patients undergoing coronary bypass surgery. Again, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial where they administered a group of patients 0.12% oral CHG as a rinse to prevent nosocomial infection. What were the outcomes? 69% reduction in respiratory infection in the group receiving CHG. More evidence that addressing directly bacterial colonization in the mouth reduces respiratory illness. Number four, here is an article published by Dr. Frank Scannapico, a dental specialist here in Buffalo, New York. He published an article reviewing other articles in regard to the relationship between poor oral health and respiratory infection, again, showing clearly that there is association between bacterial colonization of dental plaque and the cause of respiratory infection. Number five, here's the issue of dental plaque. Now, many of us have really, at least I can speak for myself. I could go back a few short years ago. I would never have thought about this issue. Here is a very nice study, Fourier study in critical care medicine, 1998, clearly showing one thing. About 40% of patients, forget about what we're doing to them, about 40% of patients in this study alone admitted to an ICU already had significant levels of dental plaque. And dental plaque has been clearly shown to be a source for large numbers of bacteria that have been associated with respiratory infection. So in this study alone, colonization of dental plaque was highly predictive of nosocomial infection, and salivary, dental, and tracheal aspirates of cultures were closely linked with the outcome as well. And again, next slide, additional evidence of dental plaque and respiratory infection association. The next slide is a diagram kind of summarizing the studies that have been published. So there's now been studies that have clearly shown the colonization on tissues of the mouth, lips and gums, teeth, the tongue, and the secretions above the endotracheal cuff, very critical, all contribute to the outcome of respiratory illness. We're not going to get into an issue of biofilms, but the next slide is a electromicrograph photograph of the biofilm that develops even after a very short amount of time, just a few days, that occurs on these endotracheal tubes. And this is a very important issue that we have to somehow incorporate the proper suctioning and timing of that kind of process in order to try to reduce the accumulations of secretions which lead to the occurrence of biofilms. In the last couple of minutes, I'm going to update you on a study that we've been conducting here at the Brookdale University Medical Center in New York. Originally, this was information published at the APIC conference in 2004 and was updated this June also in the conference in Baltimore, Maryland. Any of you would like an abstract of this, you can email me. I'll be happy to provide that for you. It reviewed basically the earlier times of this study. It'll give you obviously a lot more detail. Brookdale Medical Center is one of the largest teaching institutions in Brooklyn. It serves a catchment area of over 700,000 patients. Our medical ICUs have 35 beds, and we run on an average about 60 ventilators per day throughout the facility. including a long-term care facility that has a long-term mechanical ventilation unit. I'm not going to give you all the details about the study, but do understand that at the time that we decided to look at this, our rates were above the 50th percentile of the NNIS data that is published by the CDC, about 6 cases per 1,000 ventilator days. We decided to institute a program that was going to have two interventions, and I'll review those for you in a second. The VAP reduction team was formed, and you can see a list of those individuals on the next slide. Essentially, the most important things about the assessment process were the first two, the interviews of frontline workers and the observation of procedures. I think that these are two practices that really should be incorporated today in regard to doing proper intervention to reduce nosocomial infection. First of all, the interviews of frontline workers are really conducted either one-on-one or one with a small group. And basically, it's to try to gather information on how people do practices. Understand that this is not a punitive process. We did this not to say, oh, you know, you're doing this wrong, you know, you shouldn't do it that way and all that. Basically, it's to do some comparisons. If you ask one individual, how do you do suctioning? What are the tools that you use? How often do you do that? And you go to another individual in the same unit and you ask them the same questions and the answers are different. And then you do that for, like, say, 10 different individuals on different units and you have many different responses. Then you know that regardless of the policies you have in place, you don't have a uniform standard of what to do, how to do it, what they're using, et cetera, et cetera. Then do some observation of procedures. For example, one of the most important is actually when they intubate a patient. Observe their practices. How many times do they try to intubate that person, try to, in other words, insert that endotracheal tube? How do they do that? What do they use? How many people participate? These are very, very important things. Do they suction a patient just after initial intubation in order to reduce the secretions that might have formed above the endotracheal cuff? Another thing is review products, review policies, and review the literature and guidelines that have been published as well. The next slide shows us a flow diagram that we created from the team, which essentially outlines the variables which influences the outcome of VAP. And these are fairly universal. They are applicable in many facilities. You certainly can use this and add or subtract anything on this diagram that may fit your organization. But we use this fishbone diagram in order to produce the information on the next slide, and that is the identification of needs. For our own facility, after we instituted the program, after we did the initial assessment of the program, going back in the years of 2001 and 2002, we identified that we needed a uniform education program for nurses and respiratory therapists. We needed new standards for oral assessment, standards for oral care, standards for dental care, standards for oral care solutions. We needed to keep a closed system closed, and what do I mean by that? Well, we identified this through the observation. So in other words, if you're using closed suction, ask one of the nurses, show me how you do oral suction on a patient. And what they have to do if they're using one line connected to a suction canister is that they have to disconnect the closed suction system and put on another catheter to do oral care. This is really not a good infection control practice because we may be releasing organism into the environment. Observe where they put that inline suction catheter while they're doing the suctioning of the mouth. That may be indications that they're shedding organisms into the immediate environment of the patient and could lead to the spread among other patients in the unit. And again, this is the issue of reducing environmental exposure. Key strategy number one was education. And what we did was we came up with a handout. We used a format of questions and answers. We had questions such as the following. Why is prevention of VAP important? What is the hospital or the specific unit's current rate? How do you compare with national benchmarks? What are the major interventions implemented to date? What role does bacterial colonization play in the development of respiratory infection? And what new products, techniques will be implemented to address oral bacterial colonization? Here's the HCPAC recommendation in regard to education. I won't read that. I'll let you review that on your own. Next slide, the key strategy number two was to reduce oral and dental colonization by use of some novel technologies. We were able to find out that there was a system being made available in the United States where it would really address specifically a lot of the needs that we had. It was a system where we can now incorporate initial oral assessment. You can do that on admission to the patient, to the unit, or it can be done on a daily basis as well. And more importantly is that the system provided the tools that we needed to do bacterial reduction in the oropharyngeal tract. Let me briefly review that. First, it provided on the next slide, which says maintaining a closed system, a Y connector where therefore you could split the line to the suction canister, one for oral care and the other one for the closed suction system. Therefore, you don't need to disconnect the system and you're not exposing the environment. Secondly, you have a covered Yankauer. Take a look when you observe ventilator management on your units. Where do they leave these Yankauers? Do they put them on top of the ventilators after use? Do they put them back in the packaging and leave it next to the patient? Now, I've seen it sometimes where they put the Yankauer under a patient's pillow. These are not very good practices because this Yankauer obviously has been in the mouth of the patient and it has millions of organisms contaminating the device if it's reused. This covered Yankauer then reduces at least significantly the environmental contamination. And in the next photograph, you'll see one of our ventilators where you have that covered Yankauer on top. Is this a great practice? No, but it's certainly better than what we had before. Now the Yankauer you see has a sleeve covered, reducing the environmental contamination. The next is you see a suction catheter, and this is a catheter designed so that we can do deep suction here at Brookdale. We specifically do that by policy every 4 hours or as needed. Then on the next slide, we have a toothbrush. You can see that the toothbrush adapts to the universal holder, and the toothbrush is designed, the soft toothbrush, for doing care of the teeth and to try to reduce the level of dental plaque on the patient. This is provided with a solution of sodium bicarbonate, which is the best solution to use in order to break up the residuals that have built up on the patient's mouth. The policy here in the institution is to use that 2 times per day. On the next slide, we see a suction swab with moisturizer. This, again, is a suction swab, and the moisturizer then is used to ensure that the tissues of the gum and the lips are in good condition, that we don't see breaks in the tissues, leaving openings for bacterial accumulation. The policy here is to use that every 6 hours. The next slide is just photographs that you can readily tell. On the left is a photograph of a patient's tongue prior to being intubated. And on the right-hand side is a patient who had an endotracheal tube removed without doing good oral care. Imagine the level of bacteria that these patients may have. The next slide shows us the VAP rates or the outcomes for the period of 2001 to 2004 in this study. Clearly, we can see a significant reduction in the VAP rates that have occurred here in our medical ICU. And you can see for the period of 2003 and 2004, several months where we had no VAP cases occur at all. We take a look at the next slide as a table summarizing those results. For the period between 2001 and 2002, we had more than 850 patients in that portion of the study where we had 44 VAP cases occur, more than 5,200 ventilator days, for a rate of 8.3 or a percentage of patients with VAP of 5.1. For the post-intervention period, there were more than 750 patients in that portion of the study. Only 20 VAP cases occurred in almost 5,150 ventilator days for a rate of 3.8 or a percentage of 2.6. Very significant reduction. Again, this was statistically significant. If you look at the cost, what I did was I took the 3 earlier studies that I presented on cost and I put in our own data here in regard to those 3 benchmarks. We determined that we avoided about 12 cases of VAP per year, and I benchmarked those against each of the total cost of VAP in each of the studies. So if we look at the Warren study and we multiply that by 12, the 11,897 by 12, our cost here would be $142,764, and our product cost per year was a little over $56,000. So the cost avoided for us in a year was about $86,000 if we use that benchmark. If we go to the most expensive benchmark, or the one that showed the greatest cost per VAP, which was about $57,000 per event, our savings here would be about $630,000. So let's quickly summarize. You should be performing proper cleaning and maintenance of respiratory care equipment. If HMEs are used, replace the vent circuits as needed. Elevate the head of the bed when not contraindicated. Perform comprehensive oropharyngeal care and establish active weaning protocols. I'd like to thank the staff here at the Brookdale University Medical Center for their incredible efforts and successes. Again, thank Paul Weber for his invitation and for Sage Products for their support. And if you'd like to contact me, I have my contact information on the last slide. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, for an excellent teleclass. And for being such a pro, you brought us in just enough time for my closing comments, and that's about it. Thanks to Sage Products for their support of this teleclass and of Infection Control Education Everywhere. And, of course, thanks to all of you for joining the teleclass today. Until we meet again, goodbye.